Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. This is not a typical story of internet stalking. It is an unusual case of friendship and deception so pitiless and unyielding that it opened a door to hell into the author's life. This is an unforgettable story for today's digital world, driven by social media in all of its permutations and cruelest forms. The story begins with Susan Fenston's online search for her father's family, a search that soon turns into a two-year frightening odyssey of internet stalking and threats when a posting on a genealogy message board brings her into contact with what she thinks are distant cousins, but what turns out to be a through email correspondence with her new family, evidence of mental illness, dark family secrets, a struggle over wealth, and bizarre criminal histories emerge. She quickly becomes a focus of sexual obsession and suspicion, and her life is completely turned upside down. She soon becomes a target of dozens of frightening characters, including real, verifiable, convicted sex offenders, in an elaborate cyber hoax that includes threats of kidnapping, murder, rape, torture, and cannibalism. Remarkable in its complexity, this story of internet stalking is also a sinister and shocking journal of madness. Described by the FBI as a case in a category by itself, this book is a story about the internet, the search for family, a friendship, and a journey into the underbelly of American crime that raises questions about safety online and pushes the boundaries of our perceptions of what is real and what is not. The book that we're featuring this evening is You Have a Very Soft Voice, Susan, a shocking true story of internet stalking, with my special guest, publicist and author Susan Fenston. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Susan Fenston.
Thank you, Dan. It's great to be here.
Thank you very much. This is incredible, as I mentioned before. Among all the unique books that we have on this show, this is certainly one of the most unique. As we talked about in the just before we got on air, tell us about the genesis of this book. You Have a Very Soft Voice, Susan. Tell us a little bit about what happened in the writing of this and what happened during that period of time and that decision. Tell us about that.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your show, Dan. I didn't intend to be an author. I never intended to be a writer. Art and photography are my first loves. The book was really a creative challenge, as well as a way of piecing things back together, examining the events, and in very large part examining myself. And that some of that was really difficult. Actually, a lot of it was difficult. So that was it. Just a creative challenge. It's a very tough story. It's a bit of a jungle. With twists and turns and subplots. It was difficult to write, but in doing so, I was able to understand what happened to me even better, because for a long time, I really wasn't able to understand what happened to me. It was just too complex, too over my head, and I was just too close to it, of course. It's a lot of it takes place online, and in the writing of the book, I started it about 10 years ago, and I wrote 25 chapters in about 4 months. shopping it around, trying to get attention for it, admittedly taking a big risk as an unknown with a wild story, finding it frustrated, and got turned down by a very big agent. So I actually put the book away for 3 years, and I just didn't want to finish it, didn't want to deal with it. I had a lot going on at work. I was very busy, and I just thought, oh, I just don't want to deal with this anymore. In that 3 years, something really amazing happened. It was the emergence of social media, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera. I wasn't on any of that. And what started to sort of, I realized after 3 years when I decided to finish the book, was that the world had changed. And any concern that I had about strange happenings online and real life drama taking place on the internet were dispelled, because the world had really changed. You know, the internet had happened and everything was changed forever. So it was kind of an interesting genesis of laying fallow and then returning to the crime, the book of the crime, and finishing it and deciding just to publish it once and for all.
As you write in the book, you talk about your parents, John and Nancy, and you talk about your father studying at the famous Actors Studio with Lee and Susan Strasberg, and his appearances on live television series in the late 50s and the 60s. But tell us about your life with your mother and your father and your sister, Upper West Side, and then later the Lower East Side. Tell us what life was really like and what shaped your character in those days.
I was born in Manhattan, and we were living on Central Park West on between 106th and 107th Street in the early 60s. I came close to being born in a taxi in Central Park, but we made it to the hospital. My parents were both artists. My mother was originally from New England, and she was studying art at the Boston Museum School, and she convinced her father to send her to New York City to study fashion illustration at Parsons. And when she came to New York City in 1959, she met my father, John, who was trying his hand at acting. And he was a very talented person, a very interesting person. And he was at the Actors Studio with the Strasbergs and was making some headway, had managed to do some Playhouse 90, which is a critically acclaimed live television program from the 1950s. And my mother and he just fell in love and had my sister. And then I came along, and by the time I came along, things had kind of started to fall apart. He was having trouble dealing with the pressure of having children and being married, and maybe didn't have any other skills, and acting, of course, is not a way to pay the bills, and he began to kind of disappear, and there were some absences, and he was sort of coming apart emotionally, mentally, and made many trips to Bellevue Hospital in New York City, which is pretty well known as a psychiatric clinic. And that was making things incredibly difficult for us. My mother did her best to keep everything together, but when she had an opportunity, she thought it would be better if she separated, and then we went our own way. And life was still tough. She was working as a waitress, making about $35 a week, and holding down two children by herself with no other help. So it was really bare bones. We didn't have much. We lived in, after we moved to the Lower East Side, we were sort of bouncing around from apartment to apartment, barely able to keep up with the rent. And we lived on St. Mark's Place, which is a pretty well-known street in Manhattan in the Village. And though the rent was super cheap, we were robbed 9 times. We'd come home often from school, and the apartment would be ransacked. Sometimes the couch would be slashed open, pills thrown around, aspirin, a beautiful fur coat that my mother had sent her from Maine was stolen. The television was stolen. We were robbed quite often. Well, we moved uptown to Spanish Harlem in 1967, and still cheap rent, close to schools. Things were different back then in the city. It was very much a war zone, but in parts it was kind of a war zone.
Right.
Junkies, heroin, all kinds of things, fires, little riots. There was actually a race riot when we moved uptown, we first moved up there. It was rough, but we loved it. You know, when you're a kid, you love wherever you are. You know, childhood is that special time when you can make the worst of situations seem great if you can. You know, if you have a little bit of spunk and a little bit of imagination and if you believe in something. But, you know, my mother, who was struggling very hard, was still an incredibly talented and brilliant person. And we struggled a lot, but, you know, it was sort of like a badge of honor growing up during those times with no support. And there was actually one time when we were robbed in our hallway at Knife Point by a young kid, and he threatened to cut our tongues out if we told anyone, as he reached into my sister's pocket and took out her cash. So we did not live a sheltered life. I mean, we really got full force reality. I mean, nothing was spared. That's kind of the way things started out. As rough as it all was, I was always very interested in art and books and going to museums, and I was kind of an introverted kid in a way. I sort of took after my mother's artistic bent. My sister, on the other hand, was much more of a hellraiser, ran away from home at a very early age, at age 13, moved from New York to Detroit in the early 1970s with her boyfriend, who was older, and at least 18 years old. And she lived there for a year and a half with gypsies in a Hispanic, Puerto Rican neighborhood. I'm sure it was very rough. I've never been to Detroit, but I can imagine what it was like back then. And when she came back, she was still kind of on the run. She was kind of a hellraiser and running away and finding ways to make money that, you know, you didn't want to tell your parents about. She lived with the Hell's Angels. She got thrown out of the Hell's Angels clubhouse. It was more, I wouldn't say colorful doesn't really even describe it. But this is my life, you know. My threshold for reality at a very young age was very different from maybe others, you know, living in better situations or even slightly better situations. Nevertheless, though, all of this was just, this was just life, right? There's nothing you can really change about it. I certainly wasn't much of a hellraiser. But I really wasn't afraid of very much. You know, New York City in the 1960s and 1970s was a much different place than it is now. So that's kind of where I come from, like rough beginnings, but always with my eye on, you know, the sort of transcendental, you know, occupations of art, music, books, etc. So that's how it all kind of began. My sister and I were never really all that close. She got pregnant at age 25. She had a son, and then we began to get close again. And that was really important for me because I don't have any other brothers and sisters, and she was it. My father was never around. I didn't see him for decades at a time. But my sister really meant a lot to me, and she and I became close, and then one day I got a call from a detective and someone, a friend, left a note on my door and said to call this detective. And I called this number, and this detective was not like it is in the movies where they come to your house and they knock on your door and gently bring you the news. It's really not like that at all. I called the detective. I was in a phone booth out in the street. I didn't have a phone at the time. And he just said, your sister's dead, and you have to come down and identify the body. Well, that was for the worst day of my life, and I still find it very hard to talk about now, as you can imagine. She had shot herself in the head and killed herself. I was just destroyed. And it was, you know, grief takes a long time. I think I'm still going through it. But, you know, when I lost my sister, I lost, like, half of myself. And I, you know, have a small family to begin with. And so she had her son and helping out with him and as best I could. But yet, you know, still walking around like like the walking wounded, you know. I felt like the walking destroyed. So I have a lot of losses, big holes in my life, and it took me years and years to sort of just begin to live with it. So that's the story with that. At the time, I was living in Williamsburg, Brooklyn.
Yeah, tell us about your life in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, in '86, and the circumstances where you met Bobby Ironside.
Yeah, well, to jump right off of where I left off before, the night that I got the news that my sister was dead, I didn't have a phone, so I ran over to Bobby's building, which is right across the street, and I needed to use the phone. He was living at South 4th Street in Driggs, which is the south side of Williamsburg. I moved to Williamsburg in 1985. It was an old, beautiful old neighborhood that it sort of was an industrial giant at one time that just decayed and decayed from the 1950s into the 1960s and 70s, et cetera. A lot of drugs. So, you know, so much crime. But there was still, you know, thriving communities there. You know, I didn't move into an empty lot. I mean, there was life there, and it was a real neighborhood. I loved it. Certainly wasn't for the faint of heart, and it wasn't very different, really, from where I'd grown up in the city. So I really enjoyed it, and bouncing around trying to find the right place to live back then was easy because everything was cheap, and it was available. And I moved into a building on South 4th Street, and I met one of my upstairs neighbors, and he was living with a friend. He had a roommate upstairs, and he was loads of fun, very talkative, very entertaining, very engaging. He could hold a whole room talking with his colorful stories and his way of being. He was very funny. And we got along right away, and we were good friends pretty quickly. So it was that night that I found out my sister died. I ran to his building, and I knocked on his door, and I said, I got to use your phone. He was having a party and noise and people. It was all kind of a blur to me, but he put me in a back room in the apartment, and he let me use his telephone, where I was able to call my mother and tell her the news. So I was there in his apartment that night, and that was kind of, you know, the first of the, you know, many cementing steps in our friendship. And he was pretty supportive, and I was a wreck and dysfunctional. But I felt safe in his apartment, calling my mother and bringing her the news. And of course, then I had to take a taxi downstairs and tell my father the terrible news in person because he didn't have a phone. You know, he was very reclusive, he lived alone, liked to take pictures, worked as a bike messenger, lived in East Village, and he was just very much urban high plains drifter, real loner, didn't want to be bothered, didn't have a phone. So I had to go down and tell him in person the terrible news. So I was in the middle of, like, for the worst transformative experiences of my life. Slowly but surely got on my feet, got better jobs, learned some skills, some computer skills, and then I landed a temp job working in publishing, which was one of the best things that's ever happened to me. I worked in a lot of places in the city, a lot of industries. Temping is a great way to get into different types of industries, banking, finance, fashion, advertising, movies, television. I mean, and then there's the boring stuff too, but there's a lot of exciting opportunity. I found a job in publishing, and it was, I knew this is what I wanted to do. It was great. So, books, media, interesting people, interesting all the time. Work is never boring, and I just basically made myself indispensable to the publicity department at Doubleday Publishing. It was at the 666 building on Fifth Avenue at the time.
Wow.
So I really enjoyed that. I was exposed to all kinds of things that I always loved. You know, I was the type of kid that would go to bookstores and be lost in bookstores for hours. Like, that, I'd never get bored. So working for a book publisher was like a dream come true. And I'd get off the elevator in the morning, and I'd see Isaac Asimov sitting there waiting in the reception area every Wednesday to meet with his editor. Jack Yonassis was an editor there at the time, and she was a real attractor for all kinds of, you know, big personalities, well-known people, and it was just, it became a common everyday thing, and it was exciting. and still exciting. I still love it. But that was the beginning of what was really a golden break for me, to find something I really love to do and something that I continue to do. So that's how I got into the publishing world. I mean, I went to art school. You know, I didn't go to college, really. I took some art classes at Hunter College. So I really wasn't, big on the academic end of things. I didn't really like school. But I just needed to find something that I really enjoyed, and I was lucky to have been able to do that.
Tell us about a couple of the things that you have in common with your newfound friend, Bobby, and some of the things that he has interests in that you discover.
Well, Bobby and I were kind of an interesting pair. He was gay, and I was straight, and I've had loads of gay friends. In fact, I love my gay friends. They're always great friends to have. Bobby and I shared an interest in horror films, and I've always loved horror. He always loved horror. We were born a day apart in the same city, in the same year. So, and he was tall and blonde, and I was kind of smallish and blonde. And he would often sort of say that we were like brother and sister, in a way.
Right.
And we laughed a lot. We shared a lot of things, and we would go up into his apartment, in his loft, and watch horror movies, really cheap, you know, videos rented from the little cheap video store down the street, and we'd have a great old time. And there was one particular movie that we loved the most, and it was called The Honeymoon Killers. And it's a great movie, it's a classic, and we'd watch it over and over. We knew every line, and we would recite every line in the film and just roll over laughing. It was just the greatest camp, sort of campy horror, honeymoon killers, a pair of murderers traveling the country, ripping off widows for their money and having to kill them sometimes. I mean, it really doesn't get any better than that. Great cast. It was became sort of like our mantra, you know, our shared space. I was always interested in true crime, but not, heavily at the time. I was more into, horror movies. My interest in true crime wouldn't come until a little bit later in life. You know, it was I read a lot, but I wasn't reading a lot of true crime until, maybe the, I don't know, the 1990s. And Bobby's interest in true crime was a little more than mine. He was really interested in serial killers. And everyone's interested in serial killers, of course, tons of books about them, movies, documentaries. Sure. But this was a guy who really liked them and actually started writing to them. But that wouldn't come until a little bit later into our friendship. And I might be getting a little bit ahead of myself. But he obviously had more interest in true crime than I did. I love a good, scary story. Don't get me wrong. I really do. But there's a big difference between reading about them and then, communicating with them. It's very different.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a place where I don't want to go. I know that all this stuff is very sellable, marketable. It's chic in some circles. It's cool. I prefer a distance to it because, you know, let's not ever forget to all of these killers, we always remember their names, but really it's the victims. That mountains and mountains of victims, most of them women, seems to be. So when you really get into what the reality is, it's just a far different experience, and I don't really have any tolerance for communicating with murderers.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write in the book, and what we haven't talked so much about is this real need to have some part in your father's life, despite his oddness and his mental problems, you still this sort of need for family, basically. And so in the early 2000s, you write about you started looking online, investigating a little bit about your family. And tell us a little bit about why you were doing this and what you found.
I'd always been curious about my father's side of the family, mostly because it was a mystery, and there was no real information about my grandparents, any other extended relatives. My father never talked much, certainly never talked about his family. You know, people are just naturally curious about that. You know, kids love, I mean, kids and adults, and most people do, they love family stories and family histories. What was your father like? Really, there was never any of that. It was just like no information, no nothing. But it wasn't until the internet kind of got its footing and that I realized that there was an outlet now for me to kind of poke around a little bit on genealogy. It was genealogy.com. Now, websites back then were very clunky, not like they are today. Everything's very slick. Everything moves today. Back then, it was just like this sort of message board with threads counting down. Like, it was very crude. It was very primitive, and there were hundreds and hundreds of messages on every family page, and it seemed like the very beginning of what is now the huge ancestry search thing. It's just now tremendous.
Sure.
But I wasn't really expecting much, so I thought, well, I'm going to just leave a message here and see what happens. So my name is Fenston, but originally, back in my ancestry, the name was Feinstein, and there were no Fenston pages on this website, but there was a big Feinstein page, and there were lots of activity on this page. So I left a message thinking, no one's ever going to answer. It's just I'll get nowhere, but that's okay. I'm sort of curious about it. And I left a message asking, has anyone any memory of my grandfather, Morris, who was born in New York City in the turn of the century, gave very little information, and that was it. And within about 7 days, I got a message, and that really surprised me. And I got a message from someone named Karen Gardner, and she said that in her message reply to me on this long thread, I was just searching for my own family, and when I saw yours, I almost fell out of my chair. You know, we had the same grandfather on my father's side, which was certainly plausible because my father's father had two marriages, and there were two older daughters that came before my father and his brother. He had been widowed, apparently, and remarried, had my father and his brother, Larry, within 9 months of each other, to a much younger woman in her 20s. Her name was Violet. And after she had them, she left. She just split. So that sort of began like all sorts of terrible emotional disasters with people, as we know this happens. So I got this reply from this woman. So her comments seemed plausible. Like, yeah, this is plausible. There certainly could be distant cousins because there was extended family there. So we started corresponding with each other, and it was kind of exhilarating and kind of pleasant. I was curious. I was cautious. But more, I think I was letting it all kind of get the better of me, like just truly giving myself over to messages from someone that I didn't know that could, who seemed to be giving me information that we were on the same family tree line somewhere. But I thought, okay, you know, this is nice from a distance. Karen, it seemed to be very middle class, upper middle class, married, two children, lived in a house, and they all seemed very suburban and very distant and separate from what my life was like. I wasn't really sure if we would get along or... She sent me a family photo with all family there, brothers, sisters, children, seven people in this picture with some children, and they were very conservative and very well-dressed, and it's a formal portrait, a family portrait. And I thought, gee, this is interesting. This is nothing that really I would ever do, but, you know, people do this, and it was very believable. So now I had faces to go with the names. You know, now I was sort of picking out who Karen was and who her husband was and pictures of her little children there and then her sister. So it was all building and solidifying. And we exchanged photos, we exchanged family stories. And then she said, you know, she talked about her brother and sister. Karen had a sister named Sharon and a brother named Leonard. Sharon lived in Massachusetts along with Karen. Leonard lived in New Jersey. And she thought, well, she hadn't told anyone about me yet. She was kind of saving it. She didn't. Maybe she felt she shouldn't be doing this, or maybe she would get into trouble with her family for sharing their story with me, but she kind of kept it to herself for a while and then eventually told her brother and sister about me. And this is all correspondence through email. And I like writing letters. I've always liked writing letters. I've had pen pals in the past where we would write physical letters to each other back in the old days, and you would wait 6 days to get a letter, and then you'd write back. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something really wonderful about that art, and I really enjoy doing that. And there's something nice about not having them right there. The letter writing and the learning was really the most exciting thing for me. Meeting people is a whole other thing. So I was sort of intrigued by Leonard because he was closer by, and if he were working in Manhattan, it would be really easy for us to go have a coffee downtown. I would be willing to do that. And I think that was a time when in the internet when people were sort of beginning to meet each other through all sorts of sites. It's just a normal human experience. Yeah, you have to be cautious, of course, but they all seemed very down to earth, normal. Very normal. My family, by contrast, was kind of almost wild. You know, the artists, the suicide, you know, the instability, all that stuff. My life was certainly never perfect. So I was kind of excited about meeting Leonard and getting to know Leonard a little bit. And we were supposed to meet, and he was supposed to write me back at one point, and then he just stopped writing back to me. And I was kind of hurt. Remember, I was, belief is a fluid thing. I was completely in belief that all of this was completely legitimate, and I was kind of sad that Leonard wasn't writing back to me, and Karen was kind of making excuses a little bit, but she told me, if you do meet him, he might cry, he's a little emotional, and he can be a little mysterious. So I thought, a little mysterious, what does that mean, this... wasn't really sure what that meant. So we get further into our correspondence. We're writing about the holidays. What are you doing for Thanksgiving? Or then there was sort of a little bit of talk about me going up to Massachusetts to meet with them. And though that sounds nice on its face, I really didn't want to go to Massachusetts to meet anybody. Though I was sort of curious about all this, I do have somewhat reclusive qualities, like my father had, a little bit of a hermit sometimes, kind of stay to myself a lot. So the thought of traveling up there and meeting them and dealing with all those expectations and who knows what they would even think about me, I didn't really see myself as the most conventional person in the world. So we're getting further into this, and then suddenly Sharon, the sister in this trio of siblings, decides that I'm just a scam artist and that I'm just looking to infiltrate the family to... do what? I don't know. I couldn't even imagine. Take their money. I don't even know how that's possible. But she started going off on me to her sister. And this got sort of sent to me in a carryover of an email exchange that she was having with her sister. I wasn't really intended to see it. But when I got this email, the strange email from Karen, I scrolled down a ways to see what was going on. And Sharon was going really ballistic. Who is this person? You don't know her. Why are you telling our family about telling her about our family? Why are you doing this? She's nothing but, dirt, and you should not be associating with her and everything. And I was really shocked, saddened, and I couldn't imagine what I was doing or saying that would give anyone this impression at all. I mean, there was never any talk of money or anything. It was just holidays, how are you, what'd you do, I made a pie this weekend, that kind of thing. And so I wrote back to thinking I was all full of pepper and beans, I was just going to write back to Sharon and tell her off, how dare you? And I did. How dare you say this about me? I was really insulted. It was really hurt. It hurt me. I felt bad. Why would you say anything like this about me? It was so untrue, just when I was kind of enjoying the whole thing. So that caused a big, big cloud to form over everything. Leonard stopped writing to me, and Sharon just kind of disappeared off the radar back to whatever she was doing, and Karen would continue to write to me once in a while, and she said to me once, isn't Leonard writing to you? And I said, no, Leonard is not writing to me at all. He's not interested in meeting with me. And she says, well, I guess Sharon must have gotten to him by now. And I thought, well, what do you mean gotten to him? And it seemed that Sharon was poisoning Leonard against me, telling him all sorts of things about me that weren't true and that would scare anyone off. So everything just kind of stopped and died away. Now, meanwhile, I'm excited about this, and I'm telling friends about this at work. Hey, I met family online, and it's so interesting, and this is kind of cool because I was used to losing people. You know, I mean, I didn't talk about this before, but my father died of lung cancer in 2001. So my father was gone. His brother died before that. My sister was gone. I didn't have a lot of family. So I was used to losing people, but now suddenly I was gaining people, and that was a different feeling. And I was excited about it, and I was telling people about it. And then suddenly it all just kind of fell apart. But I was also sharing all of this with Bobby, who was really interested in all of this. Oh, what are you going to tell them next? Or what do they say? Or let me see what they look like. So it became like a, I wouldn't say it like, became like a soap opera right away, but it was definitely, you know, like real stuff that was happening, stuff that was worth talking about. And we talked about it a lot. So
who is Nolan?
The next.
Tell us who Nolan is in this story.
Nolan was my boyfriend at the time, and he was still we're not really friends anymore, but he's, you know, we're at peace with each other. We're not together anymore, obviously, but he was a younger man that I had met prior to this, then we were dating, and I had not been in a relationship in a while. I was in some rather abusive relationships leading up to that and was really getting worn out from that, making bad decisions once again, myself, I mean. But Nolan was a really sweet, easy, young guy who was a New Yorker like me. It was really easygoing. We'd hang out. We'd have hamburgers. He was really good company. And I really enjoyed having someone who was easy to be with. I was not used to having someone who was easy to be with. So I felt safe. I felt comfortable. It wasn't heavy. And we enjoyed each other as people. We really did. He was a nice kid. And he was not, I mean, I was sort of telling him about this at the time, but he wasn't really all that interested. I mean, nobody could really make that big of a deal out of it, really, because it wasn't at first. It wasn't a big deal at all. Now, and then suddenly it took a very dark turn. Bobby, of course, I kept abreast of all of the things that were happening, and Bobby and I were always online chit-chatting on AOL Messenger, which goes back to, you know, pre-social media, like AOL Messenger, instant message. And we would be chatting online, and you can add people to your friend list or your buddy list, and then you could chat with them. It was just the progenitor for all of the things that are online today. And I started getting strange messages. I started getting a lot of pornography suddenly out of nowhere. Really, triple X, quadruple X, super dirty, super freaky, crazy porn all the time, all day long. I was being subscribed to all sorts of strange listservs and everything under the sun. You know, I mean, you've heard of a lot of things, but then there's things you've never heard of, and you're like, wow, man, this is really crazy. This stuff really exists. But someone was out there adding me to lists and sending me porn, and I couldn't figure out what it is. And Bobby and I would be chatting online, talking about all of this. And I had previously gotten Leonard's instant message account, so he was part of my buddy list of AOL Messenger. And I would, though he wasn't communicating with me anymore, I would see him kind of pop on and off. Like, I would be on chatting with Bobby, and Leonard would just suddenly appear. Like, you would see someone come on. A little door would open. A little icon would pop out. Like, they're in. Like, they were here. And even sometimes there was a sound of, like, a door closing. And you could customize these things to make all the sounds you want. I mean, it was, you know, it was like a little game, like all this stuff is. So we would watch Leonard pop on and off. And any time he would pop on Instant Messenger, all of this porn would start flooding into my inbox. Like, really dirty, dirty stuff. And then at one point, Leonard wrote to me directly and said, I can make you moan. you know, something like that. And it was really arresting and really awful. And it turned out that it was Leonard adding me to all of these porn sites and spamming me and sending me all this stuff and just harassing me. So I finally, I didn't want to tell Karen about it, but I finally had to. I wrote to Karen. I said, look, I don't want to cause any problems with you and your family, but I have reason to believe that Leonard is behind all of these terrible things that are happening to my email, and I just really wish it would stop. Well, a few days after that, I heard back from Karen, and she was horrified, and she said, apologized over and over, and she said that, I'm sorry I never told you, but Leonard has a lot of problems. You know, Leonard has been diagnosed with mental illness since he was a really young boy. And though he is a Wall Street whiz and a math prodigy, he has severe psychiatric history. And she laid out in a letter to me that I will never forget. And it really described all of Leonard's, not only his psychiatric history, which was troubling and upsetting and disturbing, and not to say that people who are mentally ill are prone towards bad, you know, bad crime or evil or harm, but she also added that he had a criminal past and that he had been implicated and tried for a rape and kidnapping of a young girl, but he was acquitted for some reason. But the other two that were involved were both sent to prison. And this just completely shocked me and blew my mind completely. I thought, this is monstrous. I mean, it's one thing to have mental illness. I mean, I can certainly understand that. I have mental illness in my own family, and it's nothing to be truly ashamed of. But nobody in my family had criminal histories or hurt anyone or did anything like that. But Leonard's history was really shocking and really troubling. And she had mentioned the names of the other two offenders that were involved in this crime. And it was like a bomb going off in my face. So, of course, like everything that was happening in this saga, I would immediately show it to Bobby. Oh, my God, look at this. Tell me what you think. I'm like too scared to even read it. It's just too upsetting. And I would often do that as things got worse and worse. I would be so afraid and so rattled. I would just send things to him like, here, you read this for me, and then you give me the cliff notes because I can't handle all of this. I mean, it really got to the point as it got deeper and deeper and deeper that I just couldn't handle anything anymore. So, like I did, I sent it to Bobby. We started Googling and we started searching around, and we did find the names of these two offenders in New Jersey, and they were indeed registered sex offenders with pages on the New Jersey Police Department describing their crimes, describing the dates they were incarcerated, the dates they were released. I mean, these are frightening, frightening characters. Their pictures, I don't know what was more frightening, their rap sheets or their photos. But together, all at once, and the two of them, and only a few miles away in New Jersey, was just too overwhelming for me. So that's where it all began to go into that dark spiral.
You also write that Karen tells you of her former sister, Sandra, a baby sister, died in a fire, and there was some speculation that it might have been started by Leonard at that time. And she also talks about at 12 years old, he was caught peeping next door, and the father found him. Tell us a little bit about that, and if you weren't worried enough by the information you had, tell us what you thought after you got that information.
Well, the letter, as you said, was long and epic. Leonard had a history going back to childhood. He would... He started peeping into neighbors' windows. The father of the girl whose window he was looking in one night saw him doing this, and Leonard attacked him with a shovel and hit him with a shovel. So, you know, I'd certainly read enough true crime books to understand that this looks like a terrible classic pattern of something getting worse and worse. He was also prone to stealing laundry off of neighbors' clothing lines and wearing women's clothing. He also was prone to peeping in windows. And what was the other thing he said? I'm sort of losing track. He was sent away to Greystone, actually. He had been incarcerated or hospitalized a few times. But what went back to the original genesis of all of this was there was another child in the family, and her name was Sandra. And she was like the apple of everyone's eye. And one day, while the child was sleeping and the mother wasn't paying attention, the room or the part of the house that they were in had mysteriously set on fire, and the child was killed. And it sent the mother into a terrible depression, and she would carry around a doll with her all the time. This is what Karen was telling me, that her mother was carrying a doll in her terrible state of grief to somehow soothe what happened. And there was some thought in the family that Leonard may have started the fire himself. They never offered actual proof, but, you know, when a family says something, it's because they're kind of operating on instinct, like something's wrong here. You know, something was very wrong with all of this. So that's what sort of started the domino effect of the path that Leonard was on, which wasn't good.
To add to your anxiety, Bobby is being a friend and helps you to look online. He's quite handy, you say. He's quite skilled. And he also, you guys contemplate things like that maybe Leonard had been in contact with this Lou Burr and this Robert McCautry. Tell us how this correspondence advances and some of the kinds of messages that you receive and from who, or so it seems.
I had reported, after Leonard sent me a bunch of really bad emails, I reported him to AOL, which sort of tipped off his family. Karen, his sister, when she wrote back to me, explaining this all to me, also said that, you know, Leonard was very fragile and that the report of his harassment to me had him ended up sent back to Greystone Psychiatric Facility, where he will
right.
be dealt with. And where he had been before. So I'm in the middle of this thinking, what did I do? Right? I just stepped into this family, and now suddenly they're all kind of, you know, self-immolating in a way, right? Leonard's acting nuts. Her sister just hates me for no reason, and Karen's always in the middle, like, running interference, trying to put out little fires everywhere and take care of everyone and explain everything away and try to smooth everything out and very belatedly giving me vital information that about him that I wished I had known before.
Sure.
So after looking at these offender profiles and looking at everything, it was really becoming clear to me that this was just a very bad situation. And now suddenly they all know me. They know where I live, right? I only know certain things about them, but I seemed like I had given away so much of myself, you know, what I do, where I live, that suddenly I was on their radar and I wasn't going away because I had impacted them in such a way. Now, Leonard going back into Greystone sent the other sister off into a complete breakdown, and she was on a warpath basically for my head. So that had sort of gone on for a while. Finding out about these offenders was just devastating. The last thing I needed was someone just like hop skip over the Hudson River and I would be toast. You know, I mean, these were sex offenders, and it was just too terrifying to even believe that this was happening. At a certain point, Leonard was in Greystone, sort of bouncing off the walls and still commiserating over his, you know, his lost little cousin, me. He had sort of become, his sexual obsession with me had turned into, you know, maybe a possible real affection for me, tinged with all sorts of other troubling elements, too. None of this was ever, like, completely sweet and easy. Karen was always sort of explaining to me that I should just smile and be friendly when Leonard gets out? Should he just show up at my door unexpected, as he's been known to do, just show up on people? So here I was thinking, all right, this guy may get let out soon, and he could just pop up at my door unannounced. You know, what am I going to do if that happens? So Leonard starts painting a painting of me in this psychiatric facility. He's painting a painting. It's not really supposed to, no one wants to really tell me it's me, but I have a feeling it's me, and he wants to give me this painting when he gets out.
Sure.
And I don't know what to do. You know, part of me wants to run and hide. The other part is just too scared to fight. And another part, which is part of my nature too, which is just, I just want to straighten this out. I just want to calm everybody down and straighten it out, because it was, I could not look away. I just could not just look away, because I was afraid of what was going to happen next. You sort of keep your enemies close. You know, you keep your friends close, but you keep your enemies closer. I felt I had to kind of keep my eye on them, because I did not want to get sandbagged in the middle of, you know, in the middle of, out of the blue. So Leonard gets into a bunch of fights with his sister. I mean, the drama in this is so thick and so deep that you would have to have like 16 professional soap opera writers to move this story forward. So just to jump ahead just a little bit for, you know, your listeners' sake, Leonard is out of Greystone, and he is now back in his element. He's back in his realm. Turns out that he is also a sort of an expert in the BDSM arts. You know, he's really submerged in the S&M world, in the fetish world, and likes dress up in, you know, trends mode, goes back and forth, and he's apparently still in touch with his two former cohorts in New Jersey, McCautry and Burr. Now, Leonard is about to throw the biggest kink party of all parties in the Western Hemisphere, and he somehow tells McCautry about me, and now this guy, this registered sex offender, now has my email address. He's seen pictures of me. He knows where I live. He's seen Leonard's little cousin, and he thinks she's cute. And I get an email from him, you know, sort of like, hey, pretty little lady, you know, your cousin's told me lots about you. You know, how would you, you know, like me to, you know, come and pick you up sometime and we can go out together? So I'm just like blown away. I'm getting emails now from real criminals, right? I mean, Leonard was acquitted for his crime, and Karen kind of smoothed all that out, making it seem like it was not that big of a deal. He was just in the wrong place in the wrong time, though I know I didn't really believe her completely. You know, some people do the crime but don't do the time. These guys who had done the time, now one of them at least has his eyes on me. That is just horrifying. Horrifying beyond belief. So I'm in the midst of trying to put out all these fires now too, right? What Karen had been doing probably all her life, now I'm doing too. Keeping one person at bay, soothing the other, trying to, you know, run my own life. I mean, I had a busy life. I'm working. I'm self-supporting. I have a very busy job, and I'm preoccupied by this dark saga that was just overtaking me, and it was just overtaking my everyday life, pretty much.
Tell us about someone that you believe is there to help. Karen's husband, Hal. Tell us what he has to say to you.
Hal, yeah. Hal was a breath of fresh air. You know, he was part of the family, but though just part of the family by marriage, he was able to have a more objective look at things and often a more realistic look at everyone in the picture, right? That's usually what happens in marriages. You know, you marry into this crazy family, and you've got to, like, deal with it all. Hal was a pretty straight-laced guy, you know, married, businessman, wife, very troubling family life with his wife's family. Hal was often in communication with me. and he felt, I guess, some obligation, just because he's human, to sort of warn me about things, protect me a little bit, as much as he possibly could, because this is apparently an old story for him. Leonard in and out of either jail or either out of Greystone or wandering around or off his medication or anything. I mean, Leonard was a handful, but Leonard also had a lot of really bad friends. Right? It wasn't so much the one, but when you got one, you deal with the whole clan of his world. It was not pretty. So Hal, he kind of befriended me, and would often be the, you know, the good guy. You know, oh, I told Leonard to leave you alone. I said he should stop bothering you. But I also, you know, want to warn you that Sharon is doesn't have a good character. There was talk about her maybe, you know, she was going to get remarried. Maybe there were some questions about what happened to her first husband. No one was completely sure, but she was about to get remarried again. And all of this turmoil and trouble in the family with Leonard and his sisters had short-circuited her plans to get married. The guy she was engaged to, her second husband-to-be, suddenly was getting cold feet looking at all of this, right? Does he want to end up like Hal, you know, with a boulder load, of, you know, a boatload of incredible problems nonstop for the rest of your life? So he actually backed out of the wedding. That sent Sharon over the edge. So Hal was kind of like the rock. You know, he was like warning me against Sharon, giving me information, you know, taking care of Karen, smoothing things out with Leonard, and then had, you know, often had to take extra steps, you know, to like go that extra measure as the events continued to unfold. At one point, Hal said, "Look, I really got to level with you. You know, Karen's told you only so much about Leonard. There's actually more." And apparently there was a murder of a young girl in New Jersey. Well, she wasn't a young girl. She was a 22-year-old mother. And she had a toddler child, and she was a single mother, and she was murdered in New Jersey. And it's a terrible, terrible, violent crime, and that Leonard may be linked to that because they had dated. You know, Leonard had apparently crossed paths with her, was very excited about her, was talking to the family about this new woman he had met, and he thought she was wonderful, and they were all very excited for him, and then suddenly he just stopped talking about her completely. And then she ended up murdered. Now, I just thought at that point that I had heard all I can hear and seen all I can see. At that point, I said, "I've had enough. I'm changing my email accounts. I'm changing my, I called up, what was it, Verizon. I changed to some other carrier. I changed everything. I just locked up, shut it all out, and then said enough. I can't, it was just too much for me. The pictures of this young woman who was murdered, and she was about my height. You know, she's blonde, light hair, blue eyes, and there were similarities there that were just chilling, chilling. And I felt like I was somehow being ever, you know, pushed into this thing that seemed to have a momentum of its own and that was going to escalate. And it was just too terrifying. I was a wreck every day."
You took this information to police. This is not we've glossed over a couple of times that you've contacted authorities or tried to contact them. You talk about a Phonenberger. Talk about the 90th Precinct and what they have to say about your concerns and this information, their reaction.
When I heard about the murder of Jennifer Wipke, I went to the police, and I wasn't even sure what to say, you know. What could I say? I went in, I sat down, saw an officer, and I, God, how do you even begin? And I said, "Look, I'm getting strange emails. I'm getting very sexually obsessive, harassing emails from somebody." And remember, this is 2004. This is not a time when people are really all that familiar with what's going on the Internet. There really weren't even any laws on the books to prevent anything from happening. You know, I think the laws have just are continuing to evolve with Internet crime. So I got a police officer And she was a female police officer, and I explained to her what was happening, and I printed out some of the photos that I was getting and some of the pictures I was being sent and explaining the whole thing. And she said, she was very sympathetic, but she knew that her hands were tied. There was only so much that she could do. So I felt better that at least I made a report. And she said, look, I'm not really sure what we can do with this, but let me show these pictures to some of the officers at the precinct. So she said, wait right here. And she took my folder that I have of images I'd printed out and showed it to a bunch of officers, all male officers in the precinct that were there. And she came back after a few moments, and it was all very embarrassing for me, very upsetting and embarrassing, and it was just a total violation of just my whole sensibility to even have to go and talk about this to police, and also feeling very helpless at the same time. And she said, look, though the pictures are crude and there's nothing really we can do, but I'll take the report anyway. And I gave her my information. But then I actually had made multiple trips back. As things just sort of progressed, I had been back and I met with another police officer. This time they said I could talk to a detective, Detective Fronenberger. And he was your hard-boiled New York City detective, and he listened to my story with very straight face, very serious, but I could tell that even, you know, when I was talking about it, it all just seemed completely absurd. But I felt like I had no recourse, like I have to do something. I can't not report this to the police at this point. But he said, you know, look, we don't know, you know, people, you know, he was a lot wiser than me. He says, you know, sometimes people take this stuff off the internet, and it's, you know, it's something that they find, and, you know, there's really nothing provable here, and there's really nothing I can do. So, you know, the second or third time I went home from the police precinct, just feeling hopeless, more hopeless.
Now, during the course of this, you remain connected with your friend Bobby, who's in a relationship with a man named James. And you give him all kinds of, well, all the details of everything that's going on. Tell us about your decision to go to the FBI and the conversation with Bobby about you going to the FBI. Tell us about that initiative to contact them about this and why.
I had actually tried to talk to the FBI. After going to the police a few times, I figured, all right, let me just try the FBI. And once again, I made the phone call, got an answer. A human being actually answers the phone. They can imagine the calls they get all day long. And I explained to this person what my story was. And I could tell already, she was like, look, you need to go to the local police. And I said, well, I have, and they can't do anything. So that never went anywhere. I was feeling even more hopeless. Nolan, though, had enough. And he went and he made a phone call to the FBI. Now, this was like a few months in. We're getting to like October 2004. And this has been going on for months. Nolan had already been getting terrifying phone calls on his cell phone. No one would have known his cell phone number. I would never have given it to anyone. So it was really odd and really perplexing that they had it. And they were leaving terrifying, threatening messages for him, and very upsetting and very, very disturbing. So he had managed to get through to the FBI, and he talked about some of the stuff that was going on to them, you know, threats of kidnapping, threats of murder, threats of rape. There was some sort of cult that they were mentioning in all of these threatening emails about some cult upstate, and it was the mention of the cult element in this that got their attention. And we actually got a meeting with the FBI because Nolan had persevered, and so grateful that he did. So important. So
you talk about Leonard and this alter ego and these, again, this BDSM expert, but we glossed over this kink fest that was supposed to happen and this invitation that you had that you obviously declined, but it turns into something much more sinister than people that have fetishes. And this goes into the conversation we just had, or you were mentioning about threats to Nolan, and then threats to yourself as well. They become far more sinister than invitations to a sex party that you're clearly not interested in, doesn't it?
Yes, there were a number of threats that came through that. Somehow, while Leonard was whipping together the greatest kink party in the universe, he decided to tell all of his worldly friend, all his underworldly friends about me. And suddenly, my email was being passed around to about 20 people who were now emailing me and telling me, oh, you know, there's a whole language and a whole way of being in this, in the S&M world. There's dominance, there's submission, there's many categories, there's many approaches, and there's all kinds of wild and crazy and sometimes disturbing things going on. And I was getting emails, really terrible emails from people about, you know, how would you like to be tortured this way and how would you like to be tortured that way? And it sort of went on and on. And one of these characters sort of got it into her head that I was, you know, I was bad, I was sort of infiltrating, I was going to get involved with her guy. They had a master and slave relationship. Of course, I had no interest in any of that. And ignoring them and rebuffing them never really seemed to make any difference. In addition to this kink party was a whole other thing called the false slaughter. And that's where it really started to take on some terrifying shades.
Yes.
That there was talk amongst McCautry and his other cohort, Burr, about getting involved in kidnapping myself and Nolan and taking us upstate and to do what with us. Not sure, but there were some many threatening phone calls. So all of that is what really prompted us to go to the FBI. And once we got that meeting, I felt like, okay, at least I have a chance. So, of course, like everything else, I told Bobby about it. Like, wow. He was like, didn't really know what to say. He was like, really? Wow, that's great. FBI, well, what are they going to do? And they're not going to believe you. And this is all too crazy. And, boy, where are they even going to begin? And so I met with the FBI, and I sat there with my piles of papers and my emails all printed out and everything, and this very kind special agent named Brandon Waller, who was very patient, very serious, took my whole account very soberly, made notes as I opened my folder and showed him one thing after the other, each character in this story, all of the things that were going on, and his eyes were wide. I sat there for about an hour telling him everything. So after that, I felt, okay, at least I have this. If anything happens to us, they will know. Everything will be on file. If we're found dead in a ditch somewhere, at least they'll have some places to start. So I had to write up, after the meeting with the FBI agent, he asked me to write up a synopsis of all of this. So that was where I had to really just sit down and sketch it all out. First scene. What happens here? Next person. What led us here? Why is all this going on? So I had to spell all this out for the FBI agent and send it in to him. So, of course, I told Bobby about everything because he was my main confidant through this whole story, like my wingman, you know, who's there for everything. He says, well, I'd like to see this outline that you're sending the FBI. And I thought, and I said, why? You know the whole story. I don't have to show this to you. Agent Waller had asked me to keep it confidential. So I'm always going by the letter. I'm not going to mess up my chance, my one and only chance, by doing the wrong thing and disobeying this federal law enforcement officer. So I'm like, no, I'm just going to keep it to myself, and I'm going to send it to him. And Bobby was really quite incensed about that. And I couldn't believe it. I was like, I know he was a busybody, and I know that this was just way too juicy for him to miss. Like, he probably wanted to see everything that happened. Of course, I would too as a friend. Like, what did you say? But I didn't think it would upset him that much that I didn't want to show it to him. And he was really quite indignant about it, and we argued about it. You know, he was like, well, look, after all we've been through, how could you not show me this letter? And I was like, well, I'm sorry. You know the whole story, and I promised that I wouldn't show it to anybody, so that's just the way it's going to be. And that was that. And then things went silent, like completely silent. No emails, no warnings, no weird calls, no nothing. Everything just completely stopped. That was weird. Like, it went from operatic levels to just flatline just within a day. It was really weird. And there's a lot of it going on. I mean, this is a very densely packed story. We're doing the Cliff Note version of it.
Mm-hmm.
So safe to say, when you read the book, you're going to get every bit of nuance in what led me every step of the way and all the turns of events. But everything went dead. Like if you flipped a switch, right, the stage just goes dark. There's nothing. But it was very eerie. I was happy it stopped, but it was strange that it just stopped.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about this Detective Waller, and also the idea that that they should look into this McCautry very, very seriously. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Agent Waller, if you were going to cast a role for an FBI agent, Agent Waller would be straight out of central casting. He was very serious, no nonsense, really took you seriously, was such a good, decent person. I always felt completely relaxed and really good with Agent Waller. And he seemed to take a real interest in this, though. I mean, clearly, this was a bizarre thing to even be talking about. I mean, there were points where I was like, I'm amazed that the FBI is even paying attention to this. I mean, they've got big fish to fry, right? They've got gangsters and corporate crime and terrorism and a lot of things going on. This is just this weird noir tale that just seemed to never die. So the fact that he was interested in it all was, like, really important to me. And I didn't want to burn that bridge for any reason. But he was diligent. And he started looking into, like any law enforcement agent would, who's interested in getting to the bottom of this. Like, who are these offenders, right? Who is McCautry and who is Burr? And he started looking into Burr, and then we got the news that actually McCautry had never left prison.
Right.
Was something I was not expecting, because I had looked at his offender profiles in the New Jersey Police Department.gov website, where he says they show in, released, out, reincarcerated, when, for what. I mean, it's pretty detailed. It's like, there's no way he's out. How can he be in prison if I don't know he's in prison? And how can he be in prison if he's emailing me about Kinkfest? And how, you know, suddenly this was another bombshell. Like, wait a minute. If this one piece of the puzzle falls away, everything else can't support, because everybody was in this together. All their relationships were very clear, you know, through their correspondences, through Sharon, through Hal, through Karen, through Leonard, and through various other members of this Kinkfest world that were communicating with me. They all knew each other, and all of these events were revolving around all of their activity in this cauldron. And so with one of the prisoners, one of the elements still in prison, this was completely, it was just changed everything. You know, it's like, wait a minute, this is just not even real. Like, this is just weird. Now, this is almost even weirder, right? It seemed acceptable that there were these people, but suddenly you have one of the key people has never left prison. How could he be out and about doing things with Leonard, going here, going there, doing this, writing to me, etc.? So suddenly everything changed. Like, this was even weirder. What is really going on here? I still had no idea.
There's more to this, and you talk about Hal being attacked, and at least that's, you hear word that Hal was attacked in the intensive care unit, and his sister Janice had been alerted. And tell us a little bit about that. And also, we haven't mentioned about this Tribe of 12. What exactly these people purport to be all about?
Well, actually, it wasn't Hal. It was someone named Carl Mulgrave.
Oh, pardon me, Cess. Yes, Carl.
Yeah, no, that's fine. There's a lot of characters in this story. Carl Mulgrave, Master Mulgrave, as he liked to be called, or Lord Mulgrave, in his, you know, moniker, is the way he liked to be talked to, was one of the Kinkfest crew. And he had been given my email and was corresponding with me and inviting me to all these kink parties and can I show up to drive you, and he's got this girlfriend who is his, you know, quote-unquote slave, but things aren't too great with them. But he, throughout all of this, he contacted me, and I wrote back to him that I was not interested in any of this. You know, Leonard is my cousin. We don't share this. I respectfully don't want to be involved in any of this. So I think that sort of softened him up a little bit, and he started kind of treating me more like a person throughout this. And he wrote back, "I'm really sorry. I didn't realize. Yeah, you know, Leonard, Leona, as Leonard liked to be sometimes. He was either Leonard or Leona in whatever form he liked to be in. He's like, you know, Leona's cool, and if you're his cousin, you're cool." And then he started sort of confiding in me a little bit more. And because he was kind of turning on everyone, they didn't like it. His girlfriend, she had some very bad contacts as well, and he was sort of blowing the whistle on all of them with me, and he ended up being threatened and then ended up being grabbed off the street and given a hot shot, as it was called, which is, I can only imagine, you know, being sort of shanghaied, grabbed, hit with a needle, hit with some kind of crazy juice, knocked out and kind of left in the street. So this was just one more part of this tornado of activity that was going on since I started all of this. And now I've got someone hurt, someone injured, his girlfriend running amok, she's out for me, Sharon's out for blood, I'm just dodging, I feel like I'm just dodging glass everywhere I go. It was really hard. It's hard to like reconjure that fear that I was feeling, but it was just like being completely under siege by too many things going on at once. He started telling me more, Carl, about what was going on with McCautry and Burr and the Tribe of 12, which was a cult upstate that was started probably back in the 1940s, the 1950s, by a former carnival barker. And as most cults do, they kind of go off and create their own little compound, their own little world where the cult leader is, you know, the ruler of all, like a god, and they do bizarre things. And there was talk of some nefarious activity with this cult. Not only were they like had their cult members kind of brainwashed, but they were also involved in some really bad stuff like kidnapping, you know, like murder. And that's really what got the FBI's interest, was the mention of the Tribe of 12 upstate. And I felt like they were all involved in all of these things. Carl and his girlfriend and Leonard's friends, and it was all becoming like, you know, like a volcano, like pressure building, like something, like I was the irritant in this mix, and my mere presence was causing them all to kind of implode. So it was baffling. It was overwhelming.
Now, you write that Agent Waller contacts you one day, and he says to you that there are no arrest records for Sharon or Leonard, and no evidence that this Cerise Bork existed. And he said he hadn't spoken to McCautry yet, but we know that he had not been out of prison. And he said there was no reports of Carl being dead.
Right.
So what do you think? What do you surmise after that? What is your only conclusion after that, after all of that, conversations and everything that you assessed and poured over and rethought of?
Yeah.
What did you think?
There was a lot of time pouring over and thinking and discussing and analyzing, and Bobby and I drilled down on this day after day. What is happening? What really could be going on? What about this one? What about that one? I mean, it was very, 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 very involved. Everyone had a very strong presence in this entire thing. At that point, finding out that Sharon was never arrested. Leonard was never arrested. McCautry had never left jail. McCautry had been released from prison, but it turned out that there are certain types of offenders that, though they complete their prison sentences, they are deemed too dangerous to release. So they're put into something that is called civil confinement, where you've done your time, you've done your 20, 17, whatever years, but they just cannot let you go. So I don't know how that works with our Constitution, but they can keep you if you're deemed too dangerous to release. And McCautry was deemed too dangerous to release, and he was being held in this facility in New Jersey. So with all of that, there was only one conclusion, and the conclusion was that all of this was fake. None of this was happening. But was for sure was that something, someone, some ones were behind this. And that became even more strange. Like, how could, why, who could be doing this? Who would even care about me? I'm no one famous. I'm just some New York publicist living a life, not under anyone's watch or concern. Why would anyone care about me? Why would anyone hate me this much? Why would anyone bother? So it became more of like, first there's all these monsters, and then there's none, but there has to be someone. There has to be someone doing this. Could not figure out who. Would we ever even find them? I didn't think we'd ever be able to find out who. I could not imagine anyone in my life who would do this to me.
You talk about your boyfriend, Nolan, being harassed. You talk about people talking about, you know, all the poems that were sent to you, all the phone calls, all the people that were harassed around you, it looked like. And then you talk to Bobby, and he's having some problems with his computer. Tell us about what he says about his computer.
Well, things were coming apart. Like I said, it seemed like a stage where all the actors had just vanished and you're left looking at what you really just don't even know. But it still won't let you go. Bobby started, he told me that his computer was sort of turning on at night and it was sending messages out that he did not write. Like somehow, something, someone had hacked into his computer, turned it on in the middle of the night and started using it as a, you know, like a like third party, just operating it from remote. And he said, well, I had to clear out my Trojans and I had to delete all the stuff and I reworked my whole operating system. And I'm thinking, that's weird. How could that happen? I didn't really know that you could turn on computers by remote. And this was like 2004, 2005. The technology wasn't really there. But it just sounded really strange and it sounded really small compared to all the stuff that I was going through. I was like, okay, sorry you're having problems with your computer, but I have bigger problems right now to deal with. So it seemed like suddenly there's this sort of story emerging that I didn't even know why, but it was just sort of like, okay, it was like, okay, whatever, sure, all right, you're having problems with your computer, so do I. Welcome to the club.
Yeah. Now, Waller calls you, Detective Waller calls you and wants to set up a meeting. And he says, we got a hit on a subpoena. And he asks you if you know anyone in D.C. Tell us who you say you know in D.C.
Right. There had been an assault on my server at my job at Rizzoli Publications. I was working for a publisher at the time, freelance. And I was getting emails sent to me, and multiple emails and e-greetings were sent to all of my coworkers, the president of the company, the accountant, the salespeople, the production people. I mean, everyone in the publishing house was getting e-greetings purportedly sent from me. And so therefore, I was getting the notifications that I was sending these things out. I mean, there was a Yahoo greeting at one time where you could type in any email in the world, and there was nothing to confirm that it was really you, the sender. It just sent them out, and you would say, it would say, your greeting was sent, and you're like, I didn't send any greeting, and it's like, oh, your greeting was picked up. Like, I don't even know what the heck this is, but you're still getting it. You could have, I'm sure they've changed it since then, but this went on for a few days, and it was this terrible attack at me at work, and that was the tripwire by which the FBI could obtain a subpoena to the email address from where these were coming. or the one of the emails along the way, because there were so many. You know, I'm surprised to even know where to start. But they sent a subpoena out, and of course I was telling Bobby all of this as it was happening. Oh, the FBI is sending out a subpoena. And that kind of got his hackles up a little bit. I was like, why? What are you doing that for? I was like, well, what do you mean why? I want to know what – I want this to stop. This has to stop. I want to be left alone. I want this to end. So I came home from work. Agent Waller was on the phone. He says, we got a hit on the subpoena. And I was elated. But then I was also – he said, you know, had prior warned me, like, look, just because we get a hit on this IP address – doesn't mean that we will pinpoint it. If this person is sending this from a computer in a college library, let's say, we can't find the actual person, right? We can locate the computer. So don't get your hopes up. But when he called me and said that they had a hit, and I was like, great. And he said, do you know anyone in D.C.? And I said, yeah. Well, it wasn't surprising because I did. I knew two people in D.C., you know, particularly. But it was a big city. I mean, anything can happen, right? I mean, it was a big, wide-open question. And he said, well, who do you know? And I said, I gave him Bobby's name. And he goes, well, what's his address? I was like thinking, wait a minute, what do you mean? What is his address? So I gave him his address. Like, why would he still be pursuing this? And he says, well, what's his phone number? And what's his name? And he went down the list, and he said, look, we have to come out. I'm going to come out to Brooklyn. I'm going to bring another agent with me, and we're going to have a meeting. Well, that was just the most shocking, incredible phone call that I'd had in this all of this, that it was my friend, that it was Bobby. So I'm just devastated. I mean, I'm just in shock, like true shock, because there was so much hitting me all at once. All of the where, what, ifs, why, who, when, this, that. These people, this happened for months, police, FBI, almost leaving my city, almost moving, I mean, running for my life, and now I find out who it is. I mean, I just couldn't believe it. I just could not believe it. Of course, it was true, but it's too much to take in all at once. Agent Waller and another FBI agent came out, and I took them to this cafe on my corner that was always empty, and we sat in the back. And they questioned me, and we talked, and I was shaking, and we went through everything. And they were very sympathetic. I mean, at first, you know, this other agent was looking at me like he really wanted information about the Wibke murder, the young woman who was murdered in New Jersey. That's why he was there.
Right.
Because in the middle of talking to Agent Waller about what all of this was about and what do we do and what else do I know, I had this other FBI agent saying, well, what do you know about a truck driver in New Jersey? You know, and what do you know about this? I mean, clearly he was after something that I did not have. You know, that murder was not solved, and they wanted to solve it. He was hitting me with these questions, looking at me kind of skeptically. But by the end of our meeting, this other agent has just been sat there just like almost with his mouth open, listening to the stories that I was telling about everything that I knew about Bobby. Like, I knew Bobby was, you know, he was a busybody, he was a little nosy, he was a little bit of a pot stirrer, but I would never think that he would do anything like that to me. So that was the beginning of what came next.
What came next?
Well, I was brought down to the FBI headquarters and had a meeting with Agent Waller in his office, and I drew out a scheme of Bobby and his boyfriend's apartment in D.C. Every door, every window, every drawer, every closet, every room, what was in this room, what was in that room, where's the balcony, where's the elevator, I mean, everything by detail. As I knew it very well, because I'd been down there many times over the course of the story, visiting, trying to get away from all this. So I really wasn't sure what was going to happen next. They weren't telling me anything. They were just talking to me about things, but they weren't saying, we are going to do X, Y, and Z. They just, because I'm sure they're worried about me tripping people off. But Agent Waller also said, look, I want you to continue to act normal with Bobby. Don't let on that you know. Just act normal. And that was not easy because I was just, whatever compassion or humanity I had for him was just gone. Like, I had no friendship left. I mean, what would I even say? I didn't even know what to say. I was afraid to talk to him. It terrified me. But we had to still maintain communication with each other because we emailed all the time. What are you doing? How's your day? It's raining. It's sunny. How's work? Blah, blah, blah. So he starts to sort of get the sense that I'm not really myself, even though I'm trying to act like myself. I'm not jovial. I'm not funny. Everything's, like, really short. And then he's like, is everything all right with you? Because he knows me so well. I mean, he's been playing me like a violin. So, of course, he's going to detect any subtle changes in my demeanor. And I was like, no, everything's fine. I got problems. I got taxes to worry about. I got a job, this, that, you know, all the normal stuff. I was just downplaying it. And I was like, I can't talk right now. I got to go. So it was a Friday the 13th. I was on my way to work. I was a little bit late, and I get to work, and I get to the reception desk, and the receptionist is sitting there, and she's looking at me, and she's like, you've been getting a lot of calls. Somebody's been calling you here over and over 200 times, 200, 300 times. And I said, what? And she showed me a Post-it that was stuck to her phone with a number, a DC number, that was calling over and over again, so much so that the president of the company had to call him back and say, if you don't stop calling here, I'm going to contact my lawyer. I mean, it was just a barrage of rapid-fire phone calls. So I get to my desk, and my boss is actually on the phone with him, and she's trying to get him off the phone. Yeah, no, Susan's not here right now. I'm just going to take a message. I'm sorry, she's not here. And I can feel the intensity of their struggle on the phone. He would not let this go. So she's looking at me like, she got him off the phone. She was looking at me like, what the heck is going on here? So I called Agent Waller immediately, and he told me that they had been granted by a judge a search and seizure warrant on the residence in D.C., and that morning before dawn, a team of SWAT and FBI had bypassed the doorman in the lobby, gone straight up in the elevator. It's a very nice building in a very nice part of D.C., knocked on the door, and that was it, right? Separated Bobby and his boyfriend, searched the apartment, took his computer, took a lot of correspondence with serial killers, took laptops, took everything. It was sweeping, immediate. It was comprehensive. So after that happened, Bobby had just called my office like 1,000 times trying to get a hold of me. And I was not answering. Didn't want to answer. I wanted to just hide and run. It was just way too much to deal with.
We don't have enough time to go into too much more, but suffice to say that there was much more learned about your friend Bobby, wasn't there, by investigators. And obviously you've revealed that in this book as well.
Yes, yes. There's a lot of things about Bobby, but I think if we don't have enough time. I don't know if we can really delve into that. I think reading about it might be better for the audience.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where to end this because I think like it was writing the book. It's a real complicated, multi-layered story. There's actually so much more going on in it that we haven't even talked about, just for the, you know, to compress it all into an hour. The book itself, I had to abridge it. I had to take about a third off. There were other subplots. There were extra things just thrown in for no reason. There were other characters. There were other people. There were more sagas within sagas. It was like a wild imagination, an editor, a writer who just wanted to throw everything in and the kitchen sink just because they could without rhyme or reason. I mean, the main plot moved along, but there was so much to it that just for the sake of the reader, we had to shorten the book a bit. But this is core of the full events in this strange and winding story.
To sort of wrap up, I think, would you say that there was another author at work here throughout this entire story?
Another author?
Well, that being Bobby himself.
Right. The one the one author, yeah, the one who planted the seed from the beginning, who was born as Karen. And then within 6 days of my putting that genealogy message up, I got an answer, right? Mm-hmm. 6 days, 7 days, I forget, but it's a very short amount of time. So between that short amount of time, the genesis of this whole thing began, laying the foundations, bringing in characters, deepening their complexities, honing their personalities, working on their writing styles. I mean, this, when you really think about it, was just an architectural kind of magnum opus, right?
Absolutely.
An imagination run completely wild, and really for what? Like the sole purpose would commandeer another human being's life, right? Take them by their most vulnerable beliefs and what they desire for family, maybe filling in those little holes in their lives, and then just elaborating on it and embroidering it and marinating it and just creating this it's almost like an opera, right? It was just so much. It's just mind-boggling. You just couldn't believe that one person could not only be someone's friend, orchestrate this entire thing like a moving feast in real time. That's the most frightening part, right? The duality.
And really, too, it pushes the benchmarks for a psychopathic killer, potentially, or the psychopath's intention to destroy psychologically, to play games, to outwit, to instill incredible fear. Of course, the fear of the unknown is worse than any anticipated fear. It's incredible the effort that the psychopath put into this, and also the skill and the sheer glee this person must have had for quite a while.
Yes.
Enjoying it.
I
and
would
having
often wonder
that
what was the funniest part for him. What was the greatest part for him? I still wonder what was the best part for him. Right? Which part? Which trip to the police? How many times did I flee my house? Right? It was very systematic, and it seemed to be a real systematic breaking down, a coercion of a human psyche. Right? Mm-hmm. By manipulating them through nonstop threats. Intermittent reward for no reason, sort of ripping away their sense of privacy, ripping away their sense of peace. Over a sustained period of time, this really breaks down a person. It really
Absolutely.
Does. I was spinning in all directions. I was making terrible decisions, desperate, not knowing how to handle it. I mean, it's worth saying that I had tried to escape a few times, but there's a bit more in the story that you have to find out, where he was always keeping up with me. He would find a way through serendipitousness or just mistake or some accident or something would happen and it would start up all over again. But because the net was so wide and so vast and so complex, it was easy to catch things and to keep it going. It's like a spider and a fly.
Absolutely. I want to thank you, Susan, for coming on and talking about this very personal story and an incredible, incredible true crime story. You have a very soft voice, Susan. A shocking true story of internet stalking, Susan Fenston. Tell us how we might be able to find this. I know this is a Wild Blue Press publication. Tell us how they might find you have a very, very, very soft voice, Susan.
Well, the Kindle is now available on Amazon, and the paperback is coming soon. I know it's going to the printer right about now. So I think in a couple of weeks, the paperbacks will be on Amazon. I'm sure you can go to Wild Blue website and order books, or pretty much anywhere books are found. I don't have a website, but I'm on Facebook, and I'm the only Susan Fenston. There is. Let's hope there are no others. No others impersonating me. Occasionally,
certainly,
I do check.
Certainly.
I do once in a while, just to be sure, because Facebook is full of all sorts of chicanery. But
yes.
If anyone reads my book, likes it, has any questions, I'll be happy to try to answer them. I'm just really grateful to have had the opportunity by Wild Blue to publish my story, a very unusual story that doesn't really seem to fit in many true crime categories, but encompasses something that's actually, you know, cyber stalking is overtaking physical stalking. It's more common now than physical stalking. It's a changing world, and we're always trying to keep up with it. So I hope that people like my book. Hopefully we learn something from it, but certainly we'll be puzzled by it all. But thank you, Dan, very much for this.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure, and I'm sure the audience's as well. Thank you very much, Susan Fenston, for talking about You Have a Very Soft Voice, Susan. It has been an absolute pleasure. You have a great evening.
Thank you. Good night. You too, Dan. Bye-bye.
Thank you.